What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, listeners, and thank you for tuning in to the Eyewitness History Podcast. I wanted to look back on some of the interviews that I had done with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists, and specifically the question of how they won their Pulitzer Prize and what the experience was like for them. I always love hearing their stories, and I think you will too. First, we hear from Dr. Sherry Fink. Sherry is a journalist, physician, and author known for her work in investigative reporting, particularly in the field of healthcare and public health. One of her notable achievements is her Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting on the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. She received the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting for her story, The Deadly Choices at Memorial, published in the New York Times Magazine. The article investigated the life and death decisions made by healthcare professionals at Memorial Medical Center in New Orleans during the chaotic days following the hurricane. And now I give you my interview with Sherry Fink.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
One question I'd love to ask you might be slightly self-indulgent, but I would love to know. I'd like to ask you about what the experience of winning a Pulitzer Prize is like. What's the experience like and how was it?
So the Pulitzer was for an article that became the basis of the book, 5 Days at Memorial, which then the limited series on Apple TV Plus that came out this year was based on. So that just, there is a link, a thread there. And that was just, it was unbelievable. I mean, yeah, it's for those of us who work in journalism, that is the recognition that is maybe the most prominent or that most people know about. So of course there are is just so much great work every year. And so there's a lot that is just luck that you just feel incredibly, what's the word? It's sort of unbelievable. And then it's fantastic because it raises the profile of whatever you have written or created that is recognized with that award, of course, gets more attention. And in this case, it was about some failures in emergency response that really, really are like a big issue for our country. So it was great on that level, too, just knowing that there would be more focus and attention on these events and, you know, maybe some changes.
Yeah, absolutely, Sherry. Thank you. So, yes, what was it that drew you to the story of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina at Memorial Hospital?
So obviously, like New Orleans, which is one of the one of the cities that was devastated in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, in particular for New Orleans, it was the failure of the levee system that protected the city. And the city is below flood level, but this is just an iconic American city. It's, you know, so beloved. So many people have the experience of visiting, even if you, you know, aren't from there or don't have family from there. So this was just huge. I know a lot of young people now might not have a personal memory of Hurricane Katrina, but it was like really pivotal for our country, because I think a lot of people had assumed that the U.S. was so advanced, had such a great economy, and, you know, if there was ever a big natural disaster, that at least there would be, you know, obviously like a lot of suffering and difficulty due to the hazard itself, the storm in this case. But I think maybe a lot of Americans assumed that there would be a fairly robust response to a massive natural disaster like this, or that our infrastructure would hold up better rather than have the whole, you know, levee system fail. And it was just a big, I hate to use cliches, but wake up call for the country. So, of course, as somebody who writes about, you know, healthcare and natural disasters, and I had been an emergency responder myself, actually deployed to New Orleans after Katrina as part of a public health team that worked in some shelters around the city, just outside of the city where people were taken or where they got to. So, of course, it was just something that was really important to look at, like, why did this happen? Why did it get so bad? Why did so many people die and so many things go wrong? And then I heard about this particular hospital. This was on the news, this hospital where so many patients had died and where very soon after the storm, there were some staff of that hospital who came out and said something happened that shouldn't have happened here, and that there were discussions about literally ending patients' lives, which was just stunning. And I think I had just written a book about a war zone where people were under siege for 3 years in the country, Bosnia Herzegovina. And like, it was a war hospital. They had for a long time no supplies, no resupply. They were just doing, you know, war surgery. But I'd never heard of a case where like the staff of the hospital got so desperate they talked about ending their patients' lives. So this is just getting back to your question of what made me pay attention and want to devote what turned out to be years of my life trying to figure out what actually happened and share that with readers and now with viewers, is that this was just something really important to look at. What actually happened? Why did it happen? Why did people think this thing happened if it didn't happen? And what can we learn from it? And it turns out patients were injected with drugs, and it turned into a very high profile legal case with health professionals actually getting arrested and accused by the top law enforcement official of Louisiana of having committed second degree murder or participated in it. So for all these reasons, it felt worthy of looking at.
This next clip is from an interview that I did with Paul Moses. Paul is a former Newsday city editor and senior religion writer, as well as a professor of journalism at Brooklyn College and the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism. He was also the lead writer on a Newsday team that won the Pulitzer Prize. Here, we delve into the specifics of that story, and I also ask him what the experience of winning a Pulitzer Prize was like and what it meant to him. Now I give you Paul Moses. So I'd love to track through actually winning a Pulitzer Prize. It's a subject I always like to dote upon when the opportunity presents itself. You won it, I should say you and your team won it, for reporting on a motorman who was under the influence and crashed a train in the subway, killing five and injuring about 260 people. I'd love for you to talk a little bit, take all the time you need really, about your experience covering it, how you knew it was a story worth going for, what your experience was covering it, and how the story was received. Just yeah, five questions.
Well, of course, anything on the subway is important in New York, and something like this just kind of goes to the heart of what chills a New Yorker, you know, a fatal accident on the subway. And the editors of the paper thought it was big enough to do a wraparound section. And my job was to write the main story based on reporting from almost the whole staff. And we had some really brilliant reporters at New York Newsday. It was a great, although not permanent, newspaper. One fellow in particular did an incredible job, Mitch Gelman. He tracked down the movements of the motorman through the whole day. You know, he was drunk and he kind of disappeared after the accident, but Mitch Gelman knew where he was and he just handed in tremendous stuff. And it was my job to write all that into an interesting lead story. It led a large package of stories. That's how Newsday did it. And it was nice to get an award for one good day's work.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's one of those chill issues. That was a 2-year investigation or anything like that. It was for Spot News reporting, which is kind of the core job in journalism, to respond to major events. So it was a good thing for, you know, the paper and everybody involved.
Sure. That makes sense to me. So what then was the experience of winning a Pulitzer Prize like? And the reason
I ask is because, you know, Pulitzer, it's one of those words like Nobel that there's
not quite.
Well, I guess just mean to infer that there's an instant prestige that people, if you say you're a journalist, that's one thing. If you say you're a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, you have instant prestige attached to it, right?
I mean, for the staff, it was euphoric. We were a startup newspaper. We were mostly all younger reporters in our 20s and 30s. And to have something like that happen to such a large group of people was really quite an exciting thing. You know, it was a sad story also. And part of, you know, writing the main story was to try to bring alive what's lost, even in kind of the shorthand of news reporting, you know, who the people were, where they were coming from, where they were going to, you know, little details like that.
This last clip comes from an interview that I did with Greg Marinovich. Greg Marinovich is co-author of the book The Bang Bang Club, a nonfiction book on South Africa's transition to democracy that has been translated into 6 languages. He is also a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer and filmmaker. He spent 25 years covering conflict around the globe, with his writing and photographs appearing in magazines and newspapers worldwide. He has specifically dealt with conflict zones within apartheid South Africa, which is what we center our discussion around. Here, I ask him the specifics about the photograph that won him the Pulitzer Prize, what that experience was like, as well as what winning a Pulitzer Prize meant to him. Slight health warning for our listeners. As the photograph was of violence in apartheid South Africa, he does tell a gripping and, in my opinion, quite violent story. So I will let you, listener, decide if this last clip is for you. And now I give you Greg Marinovich. I'd like to discuss the photo that you're probably most famous for, I guess. We'll get into it. 1991, you won the Pulitzer Prize in Spot News for your series of photos of, I apologize if I get the name wrong, please do help me, Lindsay Tshabalala?
No, not bad. Lindsay Tshabalala.
Ah, I could have done worse. A Zulu Inkatha supporter who was sadly the victim of a mob murder at, if I have my info correct, Soweto's Nancefield Hostel. Nancefields.
Near Nancefield Hostel, that is train station in the suburb of Nkhlazane, and don't try and pronounce it, we'll save you that one. But Nkhlazane is one of the suburbs of Soweto, and he was getting off the train after possibly a night shift early in the morning, and he got off into what was had been a night-long firefight between ANC militants and Inkatha militants across the railway line, and was centered on this station. And this poor sucker got off on the ANC side, because that's where the train, yes, we alighted from the train. And he was immediately set upon by very youthful ANC combatants, ANC supporting combatants. I don't think they were formally members or anything. And he was beaten and stabbed and stoned and dragged over. And I was photographing this whole thing. I was there early in the morning because there'd been conflict there yesterday, or the day before, I should say. And I was there with an AP correspondent called Tom Cohen, and there was also a BBC Panorama film crew, a photographer from the Soweto newspaper. So we were covering this, and the police armored vehicles were roaring through and shooting, and barricades were being put up, and trees had been chopped down covering the road. And on our way in, we were stopped by ANC supporting residents of Nkhlazane and said, yeah, give us a gun, give us your gun. Under the concept that all white people have guns. And I said, gun, and they didn't believe us. Search the car, you're welcome. And then they wanted fuel to make petrol bombs and or to do the awful practice of trigger warning necklacing, where, you know, someone, an enemy, or especially people who are considered traitors, have an old tire put around their necks, filled with fuel and set light. This was a dreadful form of ritual execution that was reserved for traitors, but it got wider use. I think it started in Haiti, but I'm not entirely sure. But it was common practice in the 80s in South Africa and went on through the 90s. So anyway, conflict was going on, doing photographs, hanging out, feeling more was going to come when Tshabalala alighted from the train and these youths set upon him. And then he got dragged next to the ticket station. And I was photographing all along. And, you know, South Africa, I did say everything's very intimate. So it's not like I'm some kind of absolute invisible bystander. people confront you. Who are you? Who do you work for? You know, and they test you. They do coded things on you to see what your politics are and what you're going to say. And so they can place you in the spectrum of what kind of South African are you? So we'd been through that. And, you know, I spoke enough what we call Tsotsitaal, or this local kind of universal language in South Africa, and enough kind of Pidgin Zulu to make my way. And they understood I wasn't someone who was just, you know, drifting in. I understood things. So they let me stay, and they let the people with me stay, or Tom. And once they were attacking him, I wasn't a very good journalist. I attempted to intervene because exactly a month before, I had witnessed an opposite political scenario where a supposedly ANC-supporting guy was set upon by an Inkatha mob and hacked to death in front of me.
Wow.
Yeah, it was awful. And that was the first murder I'd ever seen. It was the pictures that got me started in photojournalism as a conflict photographer, because immediately thereafter, AP wanted me to work every day for them, which I did for the next God knows how long. Sigma, big news magazine agency in Paris, took me onto their books. I started getting, you know, lots of other freelance work. And so suddenly I went from a documentary-style photographer covering the effects of apartheid and mostly rural areas to a conflict photographer. And I wasn't ready. So when a month later, when I started witnessing another, what I thought was going to be another death, I was so guilt-tracked that I'd not tried to stop the previous one that I really tried to talk them out of it. And besides these kids, there were a couple of adults involved, and especially if anyone looks up the pictures, they'll see there was this thin man, like in his late 20s, early 30s, in a white shirt and long trousers, who wields this large Bowie knife. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And I was telling him, and I said, you know, you don't know that he's in Inkatha. Just because he lives in the hostel, you know, you don't know. It was early in the war. People, it was still ethnic and political cleansing was still happening. And he just kept saying, we know. And they kept attacking him, and I kept trying to talk about it while I was taking photographs. Obviously, I didn't stop taking photographs, but I spent more energy talking. And this guy, and I explained to them exactly about this ANC guy getting killed. And I said, you know, and they were wrong. They thought he was Xhosa, which is Nelson Mandela and Oliver Tambo's tribe and seen as ANC. And he wasn't. He was Pondo, which is on the border between Xhosa-speaking people and Zulu-speaking people. So it could have been a supporter of either party, Inkatha or ANC, quite honestly. And the fact he was staying in the hostel probably meant he was an Inkatha supporter. Anyway, he got killed for his ethnicity. And I said, you know, you could be wrong. And they said, we just know. And while this was happening, between the camera to my eye, and, you know, in the days of film photography, you had two or three cameras. It wasn't just one camera, because you'd run out of film at the most inconvenient times, obviously. I would photograph black and white and color, usually, or color negative and color slide. And anyway, whatever, all these technical things. But you had, like, I had three bodies with me that day, and I had the body up to my eye while I was photographing. And later, I didn't realize, but later the BBC cameraman whom I knew came rushing up and said, what happened? Did you see that guy try and stab you? I said, what? And I hadn't even noticed, but one of the youths, while I had the camera up and was talking to the older guy, had tried to stab my abdomen. But for whatever reason, he either didn't fully commit to it, because I can't believe he missed, you know, I'm a large object. I can't believe he missed me. I think it was to do with he wasn't entirely sure he wanted to stab me, but he was trying to get rid of me. And on the BBC footage, which I saw in their office, you know, you can see the guy swinging this blade and just kind of missing my stomach by, God, an inch, I don't know, whatever. And I was absolutely unaware. The joys of smart. Indeed. This is what happened to Chabalala initially. And then he got stunned and stabbed, and we thought he was dead. And then they wanted to burn him, which, as I said, was this kind of ritualistic thing. So one of the kids had a Molotov cocktail that he emptied on these half jerks of brandy or whatever, filled with petrol, gas, and he poured it over Chabalala. And then I saw the kid, one of these other kids, slip a box of matches into the guy in the white shirt, into his pocket next to me. And I thought, I'm just going to stand here. They won't burn him. And so anyway, someone else gets attacked. We all run off to that. And by then, some people have been horrified by what happened to Chabalala. They're trying to defend this person who's being attacked. Who knows who he was, what he was. He was on this side of the railway lines. He lived in the community, but who knows why he was being attacked? God knows. And the other people protected him, and some militants protected him from other militants. And then suddenly there was this kind of woof, explosive sound. And I turned around, and then you see from behind this ticket office, this man who everyone thought was dead comes at this run completely engulfed in flames, in yellow flames. It was the most awful sight, and people were freaked out. Luckily, I had one of those camera bodies I had with me. I had a long lens on it, a 300 mil. And, you know, I was very, very poor in those days. And, you know, you could buy cameras cheap. They're not like digital cameras nowadays. You know, it didn't have to be expensive to work well. But it didn't have a light meter. So as I lifted the long lens to photograph this guy running on flames, I was like trying to just think, okay, what if stop should it be? And, you know, what should I see in there? Okay. And turned out my judgment was decent. And that's where the most awful of those pictures from that day come. And then it didn't end, because one barefooted militant, in must be 20s, ran in carrying a machete, what we call a panga. And by then, Chabalala had fallen to his knees, but he was still aflame. And he killed him with the machete blow to the head. And that was it. That was that.
This question, given what we just talked about, almost feels somewhat crude to ask, but I'll power through it because I'm fascinated. I'd love to know what the experience of, I don't know how it works exactly, being nominated for, let's say, and then winning the Pulitzer Prize was like for you. What did that mean to you?
I mean, it turned out to be very important in my career and as a milestone. But it was also important in showcasing South Africa, what was happening in South Africa. But on a personal level, initially, I had no clue, because I wasn't a professional photojournalist in terms of being amongst people. And it's an American award. I was a South African photographer. The reason I was eligible for Pulitzer Prize was that the pictures ran on the AP wire. So, you know, what did I know about the Pulitzer? And by then, I'd won a couple of awards by the time the Pulitzer came around for that work. So I was pleased, but I didn't understand just how important and prestigious it was. Mm-hmm. And that came later. And there was this huge billboard for a local newspaper called The Star. And it was on this drive back from one of the townships where I did a lot of work on to where I lived in Yeovil in those days. And it's up on this ridge, and this huge, huge sign, it says, something like local lens man wins Pulitzer, and I should have taken a photograph.
Irony abounds.
Irony abounds. So, you know, it came with a prize money of $3,000. So I was more interested in that, really not understanding what this award, the doors that this award opened. And so also because of that, I didn't take advantage of it like a truly professional journalist would have.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.